Our last case this morning is 13-1527, Steve Granger et al. Versus Ohio, Auto Owners Insurance et al. For the appellants, Mr. Winchester.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Brian Winchester on behalf of appellants, Auto Owners Insurance Company and Owners Insurance Company. I would request to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. We're here today regarding an insurance coverage question with two separate propositions of law, the first of which I'd like to address regarding the inferred intent doctrine as applied to an intentional acts exclusion under an umbrella policy. In this case, the dwelling policy is no longer at issue based on the findings of the Ninth District Court of Appeals. The only policy at issue is the umbrella policy of insurance, which includes a clear and unambiguous intentional acts exclusion. This court has previously applied the intentional acts exclusion going back a number of years, from sexual molestation, murder, other intentional acts that are clearly intentional. What I ask this court to do is properly apply the already existing test regarding the inferred intent doctrine. In this case, the underlying claim is for a violation of the Fair Housing Act. All that's needed to prove a violation of the Fair Housing Act is that the landlord, in this case Steve Granger, make a statement. The statement's related to the sale or rental of the dwelling, and that statement shows a preference or limitation based on a protected class. That's it. There's no intent required for a violation of that statute.
And in this case, the insured made the statement that would not rent to families with children, right?
That is correct. That is clear. Okay. That is undisputed. He intended to make that statement.
That's the argument that this was an intentional violation. Was the insured did he have more than one residence, or was it a single residence that he was renting to, or was he in the business of renting?
They were not in the full-time business of renting. This was a multi-unit dwelling, however, that was covered by the state and federal Fair Housing Acts.
Okay.
The level of intent, ignorance of the law is no defense, as we know. And his mere statement and his intent to preclude Ms. Cozera from living or renting that property was the intentional act. The harm automatically occurs based on the violation of the Fair Housing Act. This court's already determined that inferred intent will apply for specific acts. For example, in Gearing versus Nationwide, in spite of the subjective protestations of the tortfeasor and the actor there that he didn't intend to molest the children or harm them, the mere act of molesting the child invoked the intentional acts exclusion. Likewise, more recently in Allstate versus Campbell, this court had an opportunity to review the application of the inferred intent doctrine we had a group of pranksters putting, I believe it was a deer, stuffed deer or something, on a roadway and leaving it there for seeing if people would go off the roadway, avoid it, or what their response would be. What this court found was that inferred intent was no longer for just sexual molestation and homicide claims. But in that case, we had to make a determination of whether or not the harm and the act are intrinsically tied, such that the act necessarily results in the harm. In this case, the mere act of Steve Granger making the statement to Valerie Cozera that he would not rent to her based on her having a child violates the Fair Housing Act and immediately causes the harm. And we'd simply ask that the inferred intent doctrine be properly applied in this case. I believe Judge Carr properly applied it in her dissent out of the Ninth District. And the additional issue we have in front of the court deals with the duty to defend under the umbrella policy and what it takes to trigger a duty to defend. The facts in this case included Mr. Granger and Mr. Steigerwald, the owners of the property, first receiving notice of a potential claim, then getting a federal lawsuit, then tendering the claim under the dwelling policy, then the dwelling policy issuing a denial of coverage, and then a lawsuit being filed under the dwelling policy and under the umbrella policy. What we have here is the underlying claim. It makes an allegation for Valerie Kazera suffered emotional distress. The umbrella policy provides coverage for personal injury, however, in limited circumstances. The Court of Appeals found that emotional distress equals humiliation, humiliation being a covered personal injury under the umbrella policy. These are separate and distinct items. However, in fact, if you go to the underlying statute under which Ms. Kazera brought her action, it was 42 U.S.C. 3613. Nowhere in 3613 is emotional distress allowed as an element of damage. Therefore, either it's not a covered element of, or it's not a recoverable element of damage, or emotional distress is not equal to humiliation. The terms are clear and distinct.
Counsel, if we agree with you on Proposition 2, and we say that a claim of, or just a reference to emotional distress is not equal to humiliation, do we have to get to Proposition 1? How do those two propositions relate to one another?
Actually, if you reach Proposition 2 and you find in favor of my clients on that issue, you do not necessarily need to reach Proposition number 1. To determine whether or not a duty to defend is triggered, that's the first step in analyzing an insurance coverage claim. If the duty to defend is triggered, then you look to the applicable exclusions, that being the intentional acts exclusion in this case.
The intentional act exclusion means no liability, but you're saying that the emotional distress proposition relates to the duty to defend.
That's correct. So even if a duty to defend were triggered, we then reach the second proposition that the inferred intent doctrine would exclude a defense or indemnification as it is excluded conduct under the applicable policy.
That's what I was getting to, and I think you've just clarified. Proposition 2 relates to the duty to defend. Prop 1 relates to both the duty to defend and indemnify, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. I apologize if I was not clear on that. And if there are no additional questions, I'd reserve any additional time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Lepp.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, fellow justices. May it please the court, I am Tom Lepp here representing the appellees, Steve Granger and Paul Steigerwald. This is a fairly simple case. Obviously, we have the two issues, the two propositions of law. Well, I'll start with number one, proposition of law, just because that's the order that they chose to argue these, talking about inferred intent. Now, of course, as this court knows, when you're dealing with an insurance policy, just as with any other contract, you look at who drafted the contract. Insurance law, this court has said through decades and decades, you have to look, number one, at the plain language that's contained in the agreement. It's a contract, the insurance policy. And if there's an ambiguity, or there could be an ambiguity, then you look at, okay, who does that ambiguity get counted against? It gets counted against auto owners. So here, what we have to look at, first of all, is what's the language of their policy? If you want to look at the proposition of law number one, you're talking about what does it say? It says that it's, you know, if it's expected or intended injury or intended harm, then you have the exclusion applies. Proposition of law number two, you look at, okay, the duty to defend. You're talking about, you know, when does this duty arise? You look at the specific language in the policy. You don't look at all the cases that were cited by counsel of the trial court in the Ninth District Court of Appeals. You look at how did that insurance company define the term personal injury. They define the term personal injury to include causes of action and harms. And the Ninth District Court of Appeals, written by Judge Eve Belfance, did an excellent job of pointing that out. There is no such, you know, going back to number two, I guess, there is no such claim, humiliation. This court, to my knowledge, has never said there's a humiliation tort. I can't find one when I look at the proposed jury instructions that have been put out by this court or by anyone else. There's no, I've been humiliated, I get X or Y. It's not like intentional torts that this court was talking about earlier this morning, negligence claims that this court probably sees all the time, and other torts. There is no such.
Well, isn't there the concept that humiliation leads to emotional distress?
The problem is they wrote the policy. So you have to define this term. How do you define the term humiliation? If you look at Black's Law Dictionary, it includes emotional distress within it. The Ninth District Court of Appeals cited to Black's Law Dictionary, mm-hmm. Once again, if it's an ambiguous term, they wrote this, you have to go outside and try to find it. If it's
And you think emotional distress is ambiguous?
No.
No.
No, emotional distress was not written in the policy.
Okay.
Humiliation was.
Okay.
That's the problem. They could have, when they inserted the word humiliation in their definition of personal injury, their choice, it's not in many other policies. If you look at other policies, it's not in the vast majority of them. But when they inserted that, they obviously gave somebody coverage and a duty defense at that point. And once they did that, they could have, number one, defined it. As with any other insurance policy, they could have gone, put it in the back or somewhere else and defined, the bold that one, put it in quotes, whatever they want to do. Humiliation is the following and is not the following. They chose not to do that. So at that point, that leaves the courts, trial court, court of appeals, ultimately you. What does humiliation mean? It's not a cause of action, and that's what they keep saying. Well, it's not a cause of action, so you can't do it. Judge Carr, in her dissent below, said it's not a cause of action. No one sued on humiliation, but it's not a cause of action. So it's either that they took money from my clients, Mr. Granger is the insured here, from Mr. Granger, for something, humiliation coverage, humiliation duty of defense, or they took money from him without providing him something. Well, the law is if they took his money, if they sold him insurance, if they provided it to him and they defined it, they gave them something, he bought something. He bought humiliation coverage. Now, as we all know, looking at a complaint drafted by someone, as you heard this morning talking about intentional tort cases, you know, what does a civil Rule 8 complaint look like? Does, in order for the duty of defense to be triggered, does someone have to specifically say the word humiliation? You know, this is not Mother May I, this is not Simon Says, this court has never said that. And then, like I said, the Ninth District Court of Appeals, what do? Judge Eve Belfiance goes, and you know, two judges there agreed, two out of three agreed that looking at humiliation, okay, it's either ambiguous or it's plain, but either way, you have to look outside the policy to define it because they didn't define it. They looked, they defined it. Here it is. Black's Law Dictionary includes emotional distress and all of that. Talking about the damages that were available to Ms. Cazera, I've got the case law in my brief here and in the briefing below.
What did they look at first in the Black's Law Dictionary? Humiliation or emotional distress?
Humiliation.
They went to the definition for humiliation.
Correct.
Okay.
And that's what they were defining, was the term humiliation to include that. Let me go back to number one, inferred intent, which I've not talked about that much here. And I want to talk about this because it's a very serious issue here today. Obviously, this court is well aware of the history of that, dealing with murder cases, dealing with molestation cases and inferred intent, and then dealing the Styrofoam Deer case, the Campbell case. Obviously, what we have in the Campbell case, which is the most recent, I believe it was just 2010, just been a few years ago, this court was dealing with whether some boys who were playing a prank by putting out the Styrofoam Deer on the roadway and then going and hiding in the woods and let's see what happens. We all know what's going to happen eventually, or what could happen eventually. We're all adults. We know what those things can be. You know, somebody stops, doesn't stop, hits it, doesn't stop, goes off the roadway, something, right? 5 minutes later, of course, something happens. What did this court say? What did this court do with it? This court did with it the same thing that the Ninth District Court of Appeals did, that they said they just touched lightly on and just went right past. This court said the doctrine of inferred intent exists. The doctrine of inferred intent exists beyond murder cases, beyond firing weapons, beyond child molestation. But this court remanded the case to the trial court. It's in my brief, it's in their brief on page 10, it's on my brief somewhere else. For what purpose? to determine whether the boys intended or expected the harm that resulted from their intentional actions.
Counsel, that's because there was specific evidence from the boys. There was testimony in the record where the boys said, I didn't know anybody was going to be hurt.
Right.
I didn't know there was going to be an injury. In fact, we watched what some of the cars did as they approached the deer, and some of them stopped and went around, so there wasn't an injury. So that was the purpose of the remand. There was some evidence in the summary judgment motions to go on. So what evidence was there in this case that the insured either did or did not intend the harm?
We have testimony from Mr. Granger that he did not intend the harm, that he did not know this was illegal. He thought, obviously wrongly, and I understand ignorance is not a defense in the law, blah, 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 and it was not a defense to Ms. Cazera's claims. He thought, since I don't have a certain number of units, I don't have to follow all of the laws, such and such. He thought he did not have to rent to people with children.
But in that context of the inferred intent, we're looking for intent to harm, intent to injure. So what did he say about the resulting harm? Are we only talking about discrimination here, or are we talking about this person could have been harmed because she wouldn't be able to find another place to live? Is there anything that goes to the specific injury?
He said he had no intent to harm her. He had no intent to do anything wrong.
But without any explanation as to what does that mean? What is the harm? Is it just the impact that discrimination would have on me personally and emotionally, or is it something that goes beyond that?
The problem is, if you don't know you're discriminating, you don't know that you could be harming someone. I think you have to start from that. He did not know that he was discriminating against this person by saying, you cannot rent because of your children. If he'd have known there was a law.
He didn't know that he was being discriminatory in a legal sense. He did know that he was discriminating. He did know that he was discriminating between people who have children and people who don't. He was making a distinction between those types of people. So he did know that. He knew he was discriminating, just not in the legal sense that we would use the word discriminating.
He knew he was discriminating in a verb sense. Yes, I mean, this morning I had to make the decision, do I want an omelet or waffles?
Exactly.
I discriminated against the waffles because
you
I thought they might be they might be too heavy on my stomach sitting here this morning.
Yeah.
We all do that every day. So the problem is, though, this was summary judgment, and on summary judgment, as Judge Eve Belfance pointed out, the record as developed and as provided was clear. He said, I did not intend to discriminate. Now, Judge Carr indicated in her dissent that he stated in his deposition, I discriminated or I violated the discrimination laws.
But he can't create a factual issue himself, can he?
He didn't.
Well, I thought you said.
He did say that.
Pardon me, please?
He in his deposition, he said, I discriminated.
He said he wouldn't rent to children.
Right.
To families with children.
Correct.
And then he said he didn't intend to discriminate.
No, he didn't say I intended to discriminate. He said I discriminated after the fact. What happened is during his deposition, is long after this has all happened. Ms. Cazera is calling or emailing or whatever, I think it was telephone calls, right? And she's told, you know, I have children, you're not going to give to you, blah, blah, blah. Then they have testers call them and they get the same sort of information, okay?
Well, that's my problem with the case.
He doesn't know then.
This is summary judgment.
Right.
And the factual issue seems to have been created wholly by your client. There's no other fact. The only factual dispute is on the question of
as to when he said that he discriminated, he violated the laws. That was after the fact. That was months or a year after the fact, during a deposition when he was asked point blank, after he's been pounded into him by, you know, a federal judge. During mediation, myself explaining the law to him after the fact. The other people from the group who had been calling him, pounding into him, you violated the law, you discriminated. I still have to pound it into him occasionally. Not like he's out discriminating, but he still can't believe that was illegal because he just doesn't understand that. But so he's asked under deposition, after going through an hour and a half, 2 hours, I can't recall how long his deposition was. It might not even have been that long. Did you discriminate against her? Yes, I discriminated against her. I violated the laws. That's called after-the-fact learning. He didn't say, yes, I knew back then, back on such and such a day, August 22, 2010, when she called me that I was discriminating against her. He didn't say that. What he said was that. So Judge Carr, in all due respect to Judge Carr, she took the statement out of context and moved it up and said, geez, you can't put an affidavit in here to say something different. And it's like, no, the affidavit was relating back to the statement, you know, previously, I didn't know. Basically, you know, you can go through the deposition when he was asked that question, he says that.
And so we should look at the coverage that was in place and extended to him at the date he actually spoke or acted on his beliefs, mm-hmm. back when he refused to rent to this woman with a child,
right?
Not on his educated response some months or so later.
Correct. I mean, some months or so later, he's being asked a question, which would have been a great question for him to have been asked that day when Ms. Cazera called him. He might have reflected on it, called me, called another attorney, talked to somebody with the Ohio Civil Rights Commission, the EEOC, or someone, found out, picked up the phone, apologized, corrected the problem immediately. He didn't have the knowledge then. So what you have to do is, in deciding this, is, if you just indicated, you have to look at what he knew then. Later, when he's answering that question in deposition, he's admitting everybody in the world
well,
has told him
I
by now.
I must have discriminated. You know, everybody's telling me that. I guess I must have discriminated.
Right. Prior to that, he thought you had to have four units or something or another, which is some law in the state of Ohio.
But that's a legal conclusion. That's a legal conclusion. When he says, I discriminated, he's saying, I apparently violated the law. I didn't know it was against the law, but I violated the law. But that's not, is that what the insurance policy is talking about? What the policy is covering is intentional acts, not intentional acts where you may or may not have intended to violate the law that you didn't know about. It's did I act intentionally and did I intend the harm, or can we infer that if you act in that way and you choose only people who don't have children, that's an intentional act. Whether you know it's illegal or not doesn't really change, does it?
Well, it still does. The problem we have here is this court itself has said in Campbell, inferred intent applies, blah, blah, blah. We are remanding this case to the court to determine whether the boys intended or expected the harm.
But the question to them wasn't, did you violate the law? Did you know that by putting a target deer in the middle of the road in the middle of the night, that was against the law? The question was, did you intend harm?
I didn't ask the question, though, on deposition. That question was either asked by Mr. Winchester or one of the other attorneys. They asked the question. I provided an affidavit that clarified, which was clear throughout everything we ever argued, which clarified, I did not know I was violating the law. I did not intend to hurt her. I did not intend to do anything wrong here. That's if you go back to the boys intended to put up, they intended something. They intended to put up a styrofoam deer. I intended to drive here from, you know, I intended to drive here from where I had breakfast here today to come to
court. Your client intended to exclude children from the residence.
Correct.
That's the intent we have to look at. Not whether he intended to violate the law, but he intended to exclude children. Whether it was right or wrong, he intended to do that.
No, that's not the intent you have to look at. You have to determine whether he intended or expected the harm that resulted. That's what you have to look at. I intended to drive my car this morning. If I struck someone, the fact that I intended to drive my car, does that mean I've intentionally struck their car? I don't think auto owners is going to drop me from that one. They're going to say, we're going to look to see whether it was negligence or whether I did intend to strike, okay? The fact that he said something is just like I'm just saying something right now. I intend to say what my argument is. So you have to look at the intended or expected the harm, which this court on Campbell, on this very same issue, styrofoam deer, but the same idea, remanded to determine whether the boys intended or expected. On what basis, as you've indicated? Because there was evidence that, geez, we didn't know that would happen. You know, we just thought it was a prank or a joke or blah, blah, blah. Here, we've got a man who says, I didn't know anything bad would happen. I didn't know this woman would be harmed. I don't know anything. And at that, how do we know, she would be harmed? She picks up the phone, gets another place. She picks up the phone, moves somewhere else. She decides, I'm not going to move.
Well, her harm is humiliation in her.
That's what she claims. Right.
Claims.
But my client doesn't know that's going to happen. He does not intend to humiliate her. She says she's humiliated after the fact when she files her claim with the OCRC, Civil Rights Commission, and then subsequently with the court, federal court. We don't know that. He doesn't know that when he says, I'm not renting to people with children. So at the time, he doesn't know, number one, it's illegal. Number two, he doesn't know he's harming anybody. And he certainly does not intend or expect to harm anyone, just as this court remanded to determine for the children in the woods. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, got about 8 minutes left.
Pardon me?
I said you have approximately 8 minutes left.
Thank you. I'd like to address Mr. Lepp's arguments in order. First of all, the claim for emotional distress was a mere factual recitation, not an actual claim in the underlying lawsuit by Ms. Cazera. There must be a claim, not a mere factual recitation, in order to get to a trigger on a duty to defend. Secondly, the case law in HUD versus Blackwell as to whether or not emotional distress is recoverable in a housing discrimination claim that would related to a government enforcement action, not a private cause of action like that brought by Ms. Cazera. They brought under separate statutes. Third is the, regardless of the subjective intent of Steve Granger, he intended the conduct, and the question is whether or not the harm, the denial of Valerie Cazera's statutorily protected rights that are protected under state and federal law, will occur. Once that discriminatory act was done, the statement was made, the harm automatically occurred. Whether
it
was emotional distress.
Do you believe that he intended that harm of emotional distress?
Well, he gives his subjective protestations. I think he did intend to deprive her of her statutorily protected rights.
But to do that, wouldn't he have to know that she had a statutorily protected right?
His subject
just said that he intended to deprive her of a statutorily protected right. That suggests to me you have to know that the right exists.
That answer is not in the record of, I know she has a right to housing under Ohio law and under federal law. That clear answer is not there, but again, the lack of knowledge or ignorance of the law on that front, that's no defense. The question is whether or not the harm is intrinsically tied to the intentional misconduct. Clearly, he intended to exclude Valerie Cazera, who was within a protected class because of her child, from his dwelling that was a covered property under the Fair Housing Act.
He argues that an ambiguity exists in the policy because your client chose to use the word humiliation and doesn't define it in the policy.
And, correct.
And then we know the Court of Appeals, of course, went on. What's your response to that argument with respect to the ambiguity?
Well, this court's recognized the tort for intentional infliction of emotional distress for, I think it's Yeager versus whatever, Labor Union 20 from 1983. Emotional distress has been present, has been available. It's been a valid cause of action. If my client intended to cover it, they would have included it. It's not included within the language of the policy.
What is humiliation in your view?
Well, being asked a question by a justice of the Supreme Court and not knowing the answer.
Like this one?
Well, I think that is an example of what humiliation could be, Your Honor.
My God, it's not actionable, or is it covered? Or am I entitled to a defense?
Or it's a component to another claim or valid cause of action. Is humiliation a cause of action standing on its own? I don't know that it is under Ohio law. I haven't seen anything that it is, in fact, its own independent cause of action.
Okay. But, counsel, if you take your policy that does cover humiliation, correct, and if an insured accidentally humiliates someone, don't they have coverage?
Well, that would be,
they don't
I
mean
believe
to
so.
Humiliate someone. They just did it. It happened. I'm sorry. And then you get sued. Don't they get a defense?
Well, first we have to look at all of the elements. Did the act occur within the applicable policy period? Kind of go through those steps of an insurance policy analysis to determine whether it's not it's covered. Is this an insured person under the policy that committed this act? Is the claimant also an insured person that would then bar or exclude that coverage? Was the humiliation caused intentionally? You have to go through all of those steps. So I can't answer the question generically.
I didn't say intentionally. I'm just saying a homeowner. He's got homeowner's insurance here, and he accidentally humiliates someone. Forget about whether or not you're going to pay on the claim. Doesn't he get a defense? I accidentally humiliated someone. Sorry.
If it's triggered, correct. Yes, but I don't believe humiliation was not covered under the dwelling policy. We're talking about specifically an umbrella policy that typically has broader coverage than your basic homeowner's policy. We'd simply ask this court to find that the duty to defend was not triggered on the underlying claim, and that even if it was triggered, the intent of Steve Granger in violating the Fair Housing Act and depriving Valerie Cazera of her statutorily protected rights implicates the intentional acts exclusion and also precludes a duty to defend or indemnify under the applicable policy. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. We will take the matter under advisement, and you'll be notified of our decisions.